Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And, Jim, it was just about 3 years ago at this time that President Obama not only won the presidential election, but actually won in some states that surprised a lot of people, certainly me, states like Indiana, North Carolina. And to some extent, we knew he'd be doing pretty well in Virginia, but he won pretty comfortably in Virginia. So now the president, who's really running for re-election, but is pretending to go around pushing his jobs creation agenda, which he knows probably for the most part won't get done. It got killed in the Senate. So now he's going around promoting parts of it. He's taking a bus tour starting in North Carolina. It's also going to spend some time in Virginia. The good news is, Jim, is that the political landscape has changed quite a bit. We saw it first in 2009 when Bob McDonnell and his whole crew of statewide candidates won easily, swept into office. We saw it again last year when I believe three House seats changed hands in Virginia, at least one in North Carolina, if not more than that. And so the president is staring at two states where you have a Republican governor in Virginia with a near 70% approval rating and a Democratic governor in North Carolina who, at least until Hurricane Irene and maybe still, has an approval rating south of 40%. So welcome, Mr. President. Welcome.
You know, Greg, I hate to start off the week on a bad note, but I have to wrap you on the knuckles for exaggerating like that. Bob McDonnell does not have a 70% approval rating. In the honor of Herman Cain, he has introduced his 6-9-6 plan. It's merely 69.6% job approval right now. So he's got to really apply himself a little more, and he'll actually break the big 7-0 there. Last week, Haley Barbour had said that if Herman Cain was the Republican nominee, he would sweep the South. And I was like, good, glad to hear that. I kind of almost expect that for a Republican nominee. There's a very unique set of circumstances that gave Obama some wins in the South. I think the only one you could say that was genuinely culturally Southern would be North Carolina. Virginia is a quasi-Southern state. It's worth noting that the Northern Virginia suburbs from which I am speaking are probably better thought of as more of the mid-Atlantic. A great number of federal workers who work in D.C., et cetera. The other one is Florida, and Florida, north of Florida, is considered Southern, but obviously the rest of the state is culturally and politically very different. So one thing worth noting here is that each one of those states, Obama's job approval rating is pretty darn abysmal. So there is good reason for him to worry. Now, there are some pollsters who would say you put Obama in head-to-head matchups, and he is either slightly below Romney and Perry. In a couple of them, he's ahead. He looks pretty competitive in these three states. Okay, Virginia, sorta. North Carolina, yes. And Florida, not that well. And one of the things I would just kind of observe is that, look, this is a year and change out in which three states that have been hit very hard by housing issues, the housing market collapse, unemployment is pretty high in a bunch of these states. Virginia's doing a little bit better. The banking industry in North Carolina got the absolute brunt of the financial meltdown in 2008. And I think, you know, a lot of Republican strategists who believe that was a big factor in Obama winning North Carolina in 2008. In other words, Obama's going to have a very different task before him, running as an incumbent in all three of these places. Now, having said that, seeing this bus tour, I am reminded of the question by, I want to say, Kelly O'Donnell of NBC News, who asked Carney, if Obama is not really doing this as a presidential campaign event, when will he tout the jobs plan in a non-swing state? And I think we're still waiting for it, Greg. I don't think there's any state. It's just coincidental that every place he feels the need to say, hey, let's hear about it. I mean, if he really wanted to persuade people, he'd be going to Montana for John Tester. Right. He'd be going to Nebraska for Ben Nelson, both of whom voted against it in the Senate. And he's not interested in doing that. He's not interested in going to any of these places where you have red state Democrats who are very nervous. So I think this kind of shows that deep down, this is just another 2012 campaign swing, except you and I and the rest of the taxpayers are paying for this one. Right. This is our good martini? Wait, how did that happen?
Well, it's much less friendly ground than it was, and let's hope it stays that way for the next 12 months and change. Jim, as you've just established, once again, it's all about the president, even when he's dedicating a memorial to someone else. And that's our bad martini today. The president dedicating the Martin Luther King Memorial was supposed to happen on the anniversary of the March on Washington, but that got postponed because of Hurricane Irene coming through. So here's a part of the president's speech yesterday on the Washington Mall.
If he were alive today, I believe he would remind us that the unemployed worker can rightly challenge the excesses of Wall Street without demonizing all who work there, that the businessman can enter tough negotiations with his company's union without vilifying the right to collectively bargain,
Jim, I don't know what you learned about Martin Luther King in school, but I know it's his constant hammering of Wall Street that really is his legacy, that won him a Nobel Peace Prize and probably the memorial on the Washington Mall. Or it could have been his attitude on civil rights. Now, it's entirely possible that if he were alive today, Dr. King actually would side with them, but we don't know that. But for the president to swerve away from the extremely amazing legacy of Dr. King to make a stump speech for his own class warfare pitch, just pathetic.
Yeah, every public speaker should be a little wary about saying, if so-and-so was alive today, they would believe blank, because we just don't know that. So there's probably a chance that that Martin Luther King would be concerned about income inequality today, but you know, we just don't know what lessons of the past 40-some years would have affected his thinking. And, oh, by the way, you know, you see Republicans making the same thing. And if Reagan were alive today, he'd be saying, I'm precisely right and you're precisely wrong. I'll give Obama a molecule or two of credit of saying it'd be really nice if, yes, you could see people criticizing Wall Street misbehavior without demonizing everyone who works there. And as Obama says that, I can't help but think he's got some of his, you know, his donors, the Solyndra executives, guys like that, as you know, the Wall Street executives, who should not be so demonized. But that's not what's happening here, Mr. President. That's not even close to what's happening here. And if you really wanted to have a more useful voice, rather than trying to glom on to this movement that's going on there to help your faltering reelection campaign, could he push back against this? Could he say, look, in the end, you're protesting Rupert Murdoch and a couple other executives who never took government bailouts? Where is Occupy GM? Where is Occupy Fannie and Freddie? I mean, there's a whole bunch of institutions that have not paid back their money who really are, you know, the bad guys in this. And instead they go after, you know, the Koch brothers, who've never taken a dime of government money, or at least not in terms of the bank bailouts that are supposedly getting this group up in arms. Besides the widespread misperceptions of what happened there, you just kind of get this realization it's not really about the bailouts. It's not really about the actual economics of it. It's just looking for a scapegoat, and right-wingers will do. And I don't see Barack Obama having the slightest bit of inclination to correct any of this.
One of the things that Martin Luther King is most famous for saying is that he had a dream that one day his four little children would be judged on not on the color of their skin, but on the content of their character. Well, apparently MSNBC did not get that memo because the new show Up with Chris Hayes, the weekend show, and they were talking about this quote from the post-Bloomberg TV debate offered by Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann.
Right now, we know that 53% of Americans pay income taxes to the federal government, and 47% do not. So I think we need to definitely change the tax code. We need to get it more in line because everyone benefits from this magnificent country. Everyone should pay something.
Jim, I'm sure you heard the disgusting racial overtones in that comment from Michelle Bachmann because clearly Melissa Harris Perry of The Nation and MSNBC contributor heard that, and that's what she had to say on this weekend show on MSNBC.
I'm just going to get so much hate mail for this, but I just think that's racism.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I just think that is 2011 version of the welfare queen.
Yep.
And it's just a way of saying, and not racism like they're calling somebody a name, but that what that is meant to imply, what that's meant to suggest is that there's this whole group that's dependent. And the fact is, since we developed this language that the dependent groups are these illegal immigrants and these unworking, unmarried, poor black women who are welfare queens and these criminal types.
Jim, I don't think Democrats did very well in math in school. Just last Friday, we talked about Jesse Jackson and his $13 trillion bailout plan for the states and the cities and employing every worker. Now, apparently, Melissa Harris-Perry thinks that nearly half of the American population, so 150 million people, are made up of criminals, black women on welfare, and illegals. Pretty sure there's a whole lot more of that 47% than that, but she sees an opportunity to attack. And basically, we're seeing the 2012 election strategy here is if you can't actually debate the merits, throw out the race card. Getting kind of tired of it.
You said it took the words right out of my mouth, Greg, because what she's doing here, I'm glad she recognizes she's going to get a lot of angry email over that, because she deserves a lot of angry email over that. If you want to really argue that Michelle Bachmann is being unfair in this argument, she's not paying attention to payroll taxes, and a lot of these people who are in that 47% pay payroll taxes, they don't pay income taxes. They're paying into Social Security, they're paying into Medicaid and Medicare, and that's, you know, some people say that tweaks these numbers a little bit. In the end, you know, so basically the people like Bachmann should just be clarify 53% pay the income taxes in this country. But that's not racist. There is nothing race-based about it. And in terms of this argument of dependency, well, yes, we are in the in form of dependency. We basically are paying for more government than we can afford. And we kind of had, you know, been budgeting for, you know, generations and generations, like the good times are going to last forever. When tax revenues are up, spending goes up. When tax revenues go down or flatline, then the spending still goes up. And, you know, if you look at the public sector employment versus private sector employment, if you're in the public sector, you're not really recognizing there's been a recession going on. I am getting a little bit tired of hearing federal, state, and local government workers talking about not getting a raise for 2 years when unemployment is 9.1%, when another, you know, 9.3 million people are working part-time when they want to work full-time. I mean, you know, millions of Americans have dealt with pay cuts, et cetera, and they're upset about not getting raises. I mean, you want to talk about a sense of entitlement. So in terms of this, no, we don't have welfare queens. What we do have, however, is public sector employment queens who basically are used to having a very cushy lifestyle, all things considered. They keep insisting that they don't make as much money as they do in the private sector. No, but they also get extraordinarily generous benefits, often much more generous benefits than you'll find in the private sector. And they are, all, for all intents and purposes, largely immune to recessions and the changes in the business market. Almost all the risk is borne by the private sector in this, and this is what's driving a huge chunk of this. And the idea that Michelle Bachmann is somehow out of line or should be driven from public conversation for daring to mention this shows us that they don't have an argument. There's a part of me would say, you know, you really should have skin in the game no matter what your income level is, even if it's, you know, 10 bucks a month. 20 bucks a month, some extraordinarily small 1%, let's say, of your annual income. Because if we're all going to benefit from the federal government, then we should all pay in. I just finished my my lengthy piece on Bobby Jindal, and Greg, I know you knew that I was never going to go through this today's podcast without mentioning it at least once. But he was talking about various healthcare plans. And Louisiana had this state-run charity hospitals, and they found out that when it comes to getting the patients to take care of themselves, one, to keep their appointments, and also two, to listen to the doctor and to do the follow-up appointments and to not just run to the emergency room when they have a health issue, they found out that if you have the patient paying as little as $1, they end up paying more attention to it. They feel a certain more of a stake in the interaction with the doctor. I very much believe that every single American should be paying into something. And yes, as I said earlier, there's payroll taxes, there's Social Security, but I think everyone should pay some income tax. And so people get kind of baffling, say, wait a minute, a conservative just argued in favor of raising taxes on a certain number of Americans. Yes, because I don't want anyone to believe, walk around with this epic misconception that government is free.
Oh, that's exactly right. I think that's a major misconception right now. And you have almost 50%, which is, last time I checked, if they get to 51, that's a majority. And once you get to that point, elections become very dicey when people just think they can take and take and take and take and take with no repercussions on their own bottom line. Well said, Mr. Garrity. And folks, look forward to that Bobby Jindal piece after Jim was down there for a few days just not that long ago. Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.